Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk leader.
Good morning to you. It is Monday, the 13th day of January, 2025. I'm Andy. Thanks for tuning in. Special guest today. Usually we hear him on a Wednesday, but I'm like, you know what? We missed you. Wednesday was New Year's Day, so we got Dr. David Blodgett to come in today. Dr. Blodgett, how are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks, Andy. Happy New Year to everybody.
The studio got much more beautiful today, too. You brought your wife with you.
So. That's right.
We'll wave to her over there.
Everybody wonders why she would put up with me, that's for sure.
That's what I said when you came in. But she actually argued and said, well, he puts up with me, so it's all good.
I guess it's all good.
We're going to talk vaccinations for a couple of minutes to start things off. This was on the wire this morning, Dr. Blodgett, and I thought, well, let's get your comment on it. Child vaccination rates are falling. The CDC shows less than 93% of kindergartners, this is in the U.S., last year got vaccinated for measles. That's down from the 95% rate seen before COVID-19. Vaccination rates for chickenpox, polio, and whooping cough also fell at a similar rate. The rates had held steady for years until they began to fall during the pandemic. About 90%, 92% inoculation is needed for herd immunity, where unvaccinated children aren't able to easily spread measles. And, I'm in the camp that I think vaccinations are good for us. They help us to not have these incredibly horrible diseases that some of us remember from our youth. And when I see these numbers, they scare me a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's correct. And then, so if you go another couple of years from now, the babies that have been born since COVID, the vaccination rates are lower still. Mm. And so we're headed in the direction into territory where we will probably see vaccine preventable diseases come back that we just don't need to have come back. And I think we've talked about this before, but these are not good diseases. There's reasons why we vaccinate for them, right? And we've talked about how what you're doing is allowing your body to understand that disease and how to fight it off before it actually gets the disease. So then you don't have to have the race to see who wins, the disease or you, and not dying. And so you pick those diseases that are more likely to kill you to vaccinate for. So, you know, it's hard to imagine a time when diphtheria, for example, comes back and we used to kill, 25,000
kids. Is that the one that you choke to death, basically?
Yeah.
On your own?
It builds up a gray exudate in the back of your throat, you slowly suffocate. Sounds like a pretty bad way to die.
You've seen the studies and the pictures and stuff. That's a horrible way to die, about as bad as it gets.
Unfortunately, the way this always works is we go through a bout like this and people don't vaccinate their kids and then kids die and then everybody rushes back and vaccinates their kid. This seems unfortunate that we have to go through cycles like this.
But I want to ask you this straight out. I have people, friends, who are convinced that vaccinations cause autism. Is there a link? Is there any kind of logical, scientific link between vaccinating your children and them coming down with autism?
No, this is perhaps the most studied phenomenon in autism research, and it's been conclusively disproven over time. The problem is we've put autism research back by 20 years because we focused on the vaccine issue, and so we're really far behind in understanding what autism's all about and how to prevent it and how to do better with it. And so there's a consequence to chasing myths that are not right. Bad science leads to bad decision making.
It's like when we go off in a rabbit hole on social media and we forgot totally what we were doing.
The opportunity cost is real. Yeah. And so I feel badly. We continue to see more autism cases, ironically enough, one of the proven links to autism is high fever in the mother while the baby is in the womb, which is much more likely to happen if they get flu, right? So flu actually does have a link to autism, but
there is some irony there.
But, you know, it's because they didn't get vaccinated for flu, not because they got vaccinated. So I don't know. We, you know, we can beat this round. There's people that feel passionately about it, and I'm probably, you know, get people mad at me for saying
me,
it.
Me
but
too.
The science is consistent that vaccination is the single best thing we've ever come up with to prevent very nasty diseases. 1900 in this country, average age of death, or the average age that people live to, 45 years old.
So 125 years ago, we didn't live it into our 50s very often.
Well, the better way to say it is because so many children died from vaccine-preventable diseases.
So maybe we live
when
longer.
When you average a baby out with a 60- or 70-year-old, then you get 45, right?
Yeah.
And so, so you know, almost every civilization in the world has a big celebration where they celebrate the child's first birthday, right? And they throw a big party because so many children die before their first year of age. And that was all vaccine-preventable diseases. And so, you know, bad policy during COVID, you know, whatever you want to call it, has flipped this continuum to where people, vaccinations are all terrible, and we'll pay a price as a society. We're still benefiting from the fact that as a society as a whole, we're highly vaccinated, and that doesn't allow these diseases to spread. But soon, we'll see chinks in that armor, and we see it in places. You know, there was a big outbreak of measles, for example, in New York State, where the Jewish population wasn't getting vaccinated, and they had four or five kids die, right? And so you just have to, you go through these cycles, I guess. I don't know.
So, as a public health officer, what is the requirement? Do I have to have a religious exemption to not get my kids vaccinated when they're born or when they start school anyway?
Yeah, it's not a religious exemption.
It's
Utah allows for an exemption. You just don't.
You just say, I don't want to do it.
There's a website where you go in and you can do a PowerPoint presentation, you know, to what the law requires is that you understand the consequences of not vaccinating your kids for school, right? So if your kids aren't vaccinated and the disease is circulating through the school, then the school by law has to exclude your child for the time when you could start to show symptoms to that disease. So that's the law currently. And so what the requirement is that you understand those so that you can't say, well, I didn't understand that when I exempted my kid from being vaccinated, because you've taken the training to do that.
You so
it's
make
a,
sure
they it's a free thing. That, yeah. It's online and you go on and you get an exemption and you take it to the school, and the school has to have either an exemption or a record of the vaccination in order for the child to come to school under the law. But the answer is you don't have to. It's not religious or anything else. It's just you can just exempt your kids for, I guess they call it a personal belief exemption. So, I think there's 22 states that have that. Other states have a religious exemption. And you know this, Andy. I've always said public health isn't a forced thing. It doesn't work well when we try and force anybody to do anything.
Mean like making people wear masks and things like that?
And so we, you know, we didn't, you know, that was a governor's order. It was a media-driven thing.
Yeah.
We never, you know, enforced any of that. But the, because people need to have good data and then make good decisions, right? And feel like they're making that decision for them. And I think that's where we run into trouble is when it's a forced activity. And I think we've proven that that's just not the way to do
probably
anything in society.
I failed to mention Melody is with us today. Mello is over there. Hi, Mello.
Hello.
Did you have a question for Dr. Blodge about vaccination?
Well, I was just wondering, when you were talking about the vaccinations and the parents have to be informed about how the vaccination helps their child or prevents them from getting diseases, and then you said they're, like, taken out of school, does that mean if the disease is going around, how does that even matter? Like, they're the ones that aren't protected. Everyone else is protected, but they're removed? I'm just trying to understand what you said there.
Yeah, so they don't have to be informed about the benefits of vaccination. They have to be informed about the consequences of not being vaccinated in school.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're trying to do is stop the spread of that disease. So there's always this problem in when we have talk about vaccine policy, and that is there are a certain number, certain percentage of kids, probably 5 or somewhere in between 5 and 10%, that even though they get vaccinated, the vaccination doesn't work, right? There's always, in any activity, it just their immune system isn't competent enough to handle it. And so they tend to be the frailest of the kids, right? Mm. And the ones most likely to die from whatever disease you're talking about. And so the goal is to not just have it just spread rapidly through the school and have a bunch of people sick with a disease that can kill people, right? And so if they're not going to get vaccinated, then the law says, well, during the time when that is spreading and they have the potential to pop up with that disease and continue the spread, they have to be out of school. Mm. They're excluded from school. So
okay. So vaccines, while incredibly high rate of success, they are not foolproof. Like you said, there may be 5% that might still get it, whatever it is.
Well, nothing's foolproof. And,
yeah.
But we want
foolproof. can you make it?
Well, maybe that's the next step of vaccines. I don't know. Try to get a foolproof vaccine. But that was part of the rhetoric around COVID that was not right. Flu often in those really highly changing, very variable, moving around kinds of diseases like COVID and flu, the vaccine keeps it from being a severe form, keeps you from dying or going to the hospital, but you still can get sick, right? So that makes it.
Well, then everybody's like, "Well, that didn't stop me from getting
work. I still got sick, but it did work from the standpoint of
you didn't get keeping, it as
bad, reducing hospitalizations, reducing deaths, and stuff like that." So often, public health is a science of populations, right? And we tend to view things through the lens of our personal interaction with it. And so we're trying to do the best good we can for the entire population. And hopefully that includes the majority of people that are in there. It always does. But the reality is your individual experience, you might, you know, if the flu vaccine is 70 or 80% effective and you're, you know, at preventing the disease, that's pretty darn good. Even if it's 60% or something. But if it's 90% or 100% effective at keeping people out of the hospital, that's a big deal, right? Because flu remains the number one killer in the United States. I was talking about it before COVID. COVID took over for a year or two. Now we're back to flu being the number one killer in the United States, and it'll stay there probably forever. And yet, you know, flu vaccine rates are down. You know, we'll see more hospitalizations. It's just the cycle we go through.
So it's kind of a misconception when all the, even, you know, guy Clay and Buck and those guys were getting on the radio saying, well, the vaccine didn't stop me from getting it. That is not entirely true. That's not the goal completely of a vaccine, is it?
No, you're trying to reduce the overall impact of the virus on society, the number of hospitalizations, the number of days you're out of sick work sick, your the number of deaths. You know, those are the kinds of things you're looking at as a success rate for a vaccine.
So everybody that says, "Well, I got the vaccine and I got it anyway," they don't understand what a vaccination does.
Yeah. But I will grant that in the media and the rhetoric, the political rhetoric, it was like, oh, this, the reason we're forcing this is that it will prevent the disease and nobody will get sick again. And that was just wrong. It was bad policy, right? And so you have to be able to tease out the intent and really reality of what vaccination does versus what the political rhetoric and the really nonsense that went on in COVID.
Yeah, because they were, a lot of the leaders were going around saying, if you get this, you won't get COVID, period.
And the initial claims on how effective the vaccine was were over promised, and that's, you know, we just have to.
I have a question for you. Sorry.
Fire away.
With the mRNA, is that what it's called, mRNA?
Yes.
That's in the vaccine. I have heard, and I know this is probably not true, and you can make everything clear again, but it's causing some type of blood cancers. I have a cousin's husband that got blood cancer, and the doctor said that they're not like officially saying it, but because he got the vaccine, that it's causing blood cancers, and now he has cancer from the vaccine.
Is that possible? Could that happen?
I don't know.
What is that, mRNA? What does that even mean?
So your body is rife with mRNA, right? I mean, it's what happens is there's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Your body takes a ribosome, it's called, and scans through the DNA and pulls off of that mRNA, which is it's a messenger RNA. The messenger RNA then is code for a protein, so then another ribosome comes along, translates that into a protein, right? It's the mechanism of reading DNA. So the genius of an mRNA virus is that you create the ability to help your body identify a foreign antigen, a virus, in this case COVID, but they're using it in the science for vaccines they're looking at vaccines for cancer and for all kinds of things, with this idea that now, instead of, you know, grinding up the bug with it, has the bug and the virus and the DNA and all that stuff together and injecting it into you, which is what some of the old vaccines are. You can take this piece that's highly identifiable by your body, antigenic, they call it, and allow your body then to quickly identify and have identified for it the ability to fight off this bug. So, I don't know what the mechanism would be to take that from that to blood cancer.
Yeah, they said that it changed the DNA and, like, made different identifiers.
Yeah, it can't change the DNA.
Okay, then
that's
maybe.
Impossible.
Okay.
But here's the problem we always run into, right, with particularly with cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
25% of us will have and probably die from cancer in our lives.
Wow.
It's a high number, right?
Yeah. Wow.
And so everybody wants, it's the same problem we have with vaccination. Everybody wants to identify and blame something for that.
Why did this happen?
And so when you have an event that that is identifiable, then it's easy to blame that event for what's going on. And so, in the world of cancer clusters and cancer research and stuff like that, you know, everything gets blamed. Cancer gets blamed on everything. But the reality is, living causes cancer.
Yeah.
And so to tease out one particular component of the spectrum of everything that can, we every day we have a cancer cell or two or three or hundreds or thousands. Mm-hmm. This depends, and our bodies, all those screening mechanisms we're talking about, which even MRA is part of, they help screen all of that out. Mm-hmm. We continually find it and repair it and get rid of the damage, but sometimes it's just missed, or it's too much, or there's one of the screening steps gets knocked out, and so it doesn't happen. I mean, the complexity of cancer is really fascinating to study, but the reality is, let me illustrate.
Okay, I love illustrations.
when I was working in Maryland, mm-hmm. there were firefighters that had the same type of brain cancer.
Okay.
And the claim from the firefighters was, we got this by running into burning buildings, mm-hmm. and you know, something about thinking. The burning stuff that was there that gave us the brain cancer. But when you went back, and so they commissioned this huge study out of Hopkins to, you know, figure out, to nail it down, and then you could, you know, and in the end, you just couldn't find it.
The
link wasn't there. It wasn't outside the statistical norm of what you would expect for cancers in any population. And I anytime somebody claims that something is causing cancer, be really careful about whether or not you take that as the gospel truth or not.
I remember, it's been 25 years now, my brother-in-law got some sort of colon cancer. I don't know where, how, you know, where in the colon it was, but he got colon cancer. And the first, exactly what you said, Dr. Blodgett, first thing was, why? Why did he get that? What did he do wrong? And, you know, some of the family members were like, you know, my sister is an amazing cook. And when you're an amazing cook, you use, you know, lard and all the stuff that makes great food. Well, it must be her cooking that made him sick. And I know it sounds stupid now, but when someone has cancer, you're looking for a reason. Why did this happen to me?
Yeah.
You know? And I've seen that again and again in other kind of cancers over the last 2.5 decades.
Right. And then they don't want to acknowledge the things that you can do that are proven to reduce cancer.
Right.
So, in the case of colon cancer, eating more fiber in your diet actually has been proven. Because what it does is it helps clean out all the stuff that might cause cancer, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not specifically focusing on what's causing it, but you're focusing on what prevents it, right? So exercise, all of the boring stuff, maintaining a healthy weight, you know, what you eat makes a difference. All that stuff is what really
you didn't make in your favorite one. Getting enough sleep.
Yep, getting enough sleep. Yeah, well, see, I've got you trained,
right? You do.
So those are the things that actually consistently come through as hits of why do people live longer and not get cancer? It's not that they don't get cancer. It's that they have a lifestyle and a diet and everything that helps them reverse that and get rid of it, right? But when you do a lot of things that build up to kind of hamper your body's ability to fight off cancer or whatever it is, then you can get it.
My wife likes to study people who live a long time. Right now, the oldest person in the world is almost 117. And it's funny, she read this book and it talked about all these pockets of areas of the world where people live to be over 100 years old. And they were trying to find a causality, a reason why they were living so long. And it's funny, two things showed up in their diet quite often. One was fish.
The other
was beans, of all things.
Yep.
Like beans.
Good old black beans, right? So they call them blue zones when they study them. They're areas with higher than expected rates of living to be past 100. And, yeah, consistently those things show up there. But they also have simpler lifestyles. They walk a lot more.
Yeah, they do. There are no cars or mass transit where they are usually.
That's where some of this data that I keep harping on comes from, is from those kinds of populations where they say, you know, if you want to get rid of 70% of what you were dying from, it's all about your diet, your exercise, your keeping your weight in the right range, and not smoking. Smoking is the one we seem to hold on to pretty well in our society. About 20% of people still smoke.
20%. And if you go to Europe, I was there this last summer, probably like 50%.
Yeah.
I mean, they smoke a lot.
Yeah. So.
All right, I got to get a weather break in, and we'll have more with Dr. Blodgett. I want to talk a little bit about, we've got a couple of things about or trips to the ER and what the public health can do to reduce that. Maybe we'll be right back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back, 936 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Dr. David Blodgett is here today, along with Mello. Hi, Mello.
Hello.
She is here. All right, good. We always, you know, she's in another studio, and I can kind of see her, but there's a glare in the window, so it's hard to see her. And then sometimes buttons get pushed in that other studio, and I know I've had several different times, Mello, where I'm like, Mello's here, and then nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. I'm not there, but I'm here. You just forgot to turn my mic on.
No. Sometimes it's my fault. Sometimes it's buttons in there that get pushed.
That's true. It's me, too.
You never know. And, well, not even you. It's whoever was in there last was pushing things around. But anyway, it's great to have you. I wanted to talk for a few minutes, if you don't mind, Dr. Blodgett, about reasons that people go to the emergency room and how public health figures in that. Now, we can go back to, like you said, the boring stuff, right? Exercise, getting enough sleep, not smoking, not drinking. And which one am I missing? I think that's most of them.
Keep maintaining a healthy weight.
Oh, diet. Yeah, diet and maintaining a healthy weight. But there are trips to ER. I've unfortunately been to the ER a few times in the last couple of years. And my problem, I don't... it's a weird one. I get sepsis because I have, you know, neuropathy in my feet, and I can't tell when I... Anyway, that's a whole other deal. But the average person goes to the ER for a lot of different reasons. Number one reason, I'm told, are ground-level falls, which I don't know that the public health department can do a whole lot about ground-level falls. I was amazed at ground-level falls, which means not on the stairs, not on a ladder, but you trip over a rug or your pet or something in the house. I was surprised that was number one over elevated falls, which does include stairs and ladders and things like that. But, yeah, ground-level falls is number one. Can public health do anything about that? Is that...
Well, we try.
Okay.
We try to do education around that and say, you know, how do you...
Education.
How do you make yourself resistant to the impact that those falls could have? Because I think people are going to fall.
Yeah,
but
I know I have.
But they don't fall if they maintain core strength and stuff like that, right? True. And so as the older you get, the more likely this tends to happen. But, it can happen at any age. And it's core muscle strength that helps maintain the ability to not fall.
Sure.
Or clutter. I tripped on some clutter.
Right. So you're jumping ahead on me, which is good. So it is amazing to us. So we'll do trainings, and we've actually had times where we'll just go into a home and give recommendations, and almost always, I don't know what it is, people love those throw rugs, right?
Those throw rugs,
on the floor.
We all have
them. And yet they are a trip risk, a fall risk, and people just refuse to get rid of them. But they are a big problem. They really are. Hmm. And
anecdotal evidence, last week I was going out. I had something on the smoker. I was going out at a big old, one of those industrial-sized aluminum foils. Takes two hands to carry it. I go out the door, and guess what's right by the back door?
Yep.
A throw rug, and guess what I tripped on with my hands full because I couldn't grab onto anything.
Yeah, you're focused on navigating through space. You catch the edge of the rug. It's like
exactly
the perfect trip device, and there you go. And so getting rid of throw rugs is a big recommendation to avoid these ground-level falls, and yet people just really struggle to do that because it's part of the decoration of their home and all that stuff.
Is there an age that it's more recommended?
Yeah, I mean, I get above...
above zero.
Above 65.
Okay, 65. Sure, you know, I'm good then. Okay.
And
he was trying to be nice because I'm only 58 and I tripped on one. Actually, twice I've done
it.
He
meant 55, Andy.
Certainly, as you get, north of 70 or 75, I think I would just say this is not something that I need to have in my home.
Keeps your feet warm, though. It's nice when you're sitting there.
I know. I know.
My house is almost all, except for the bedrooms, except for actually the two bedrooms in the back, is almost all hardwood floors. So throw rugs, like Mello said, it helps keep your feet warm. If water spills or whatever, to have a rug there as opposed to just, the wood floors, it's...
Cushions don't end up getting, palmar fasciitis or plantar fasciitis on your feet. Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons why rugs are nice and why people like them. I'm just telling you, they're a big risk for falls.
Well, and we're talking about this a little tongue-in-cheek, but these falls you get, I know people who have died from tripping on a rug and hitting their head on, the fireplace or the stove or the fridge or whatever. It's real.
Well, and... perhaps even more alarming is the statistics on if you fall and break a hip, the survival rate at a year is low, right?
Yeah, for a broken hip.
I hate to say it this way, but it's kind of a death sentence, right? You breaking your hip, it's very difficult to come back from that because you've lost that muscle mass we've been talking about and just, trying to rehabilitate after that is very difficult. So you want to protect from falls and being strong, exercising, maintaining muscle mass is important to that, but also being aware of clutter and things that can trip you, not walking around in the dark, and you can't see, things like that, those are things that can happen.
Well, especially if you have balance issues, because a big one-third of balance is being able to see, right? And if you're walking around in the dark, I know I have a problem with that because I don't have very good inner ear and, the other two are feel and vision. Well, I have neuropathy in my feet And so then it comes down to vision. And if it's dark out, I really struggle. Yeah. And I know a lot of people, when it's dark, they, yeah, don't walk around in the dark if you don't have to.
Yeah, but it's tempting, right? Because you don't want to wake up anymore than you have to.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's all these kind of things that are modern conveniences and luxuries that can end up being as harmful.
Can I ask one more question about the hips?
Sure.
I heard, and I'm not sure if there's truth to it, that when somebody kind of falls and breaks their hip, that actually their hip broke and then they fell. Like it's a bone issue. Like the bone is so brittle that it breaks and then they fall. So it's not necessarily the fall broke their hip, but the hip broke and then they fell. Have you ever heard that before?
I think it's possible, but it's less likely than the other scenario. I mean, if you're functioning normally and able to walk and stuff like that, generally that hip bone is okay. But there are, part of what you're getting at is osteoporosis.
Right.
If you have fragile bones, if they're not, the bone density is not where it should be to maintain that, then you're much more likely to break it should you fall. I don't want that to be something people thinking around me, just be walking around and, break my hip and fall down. That's a rarity.
It is really rare.
Generally a broken
compared
hip.
Compared to the others.
It ain't going to break itself, right? Blunt force
the kind
is
of,
going
to
break.
The kind of force you need to do that is just usually just walking, maybe they tripped or something, or,
fell into something.
I wouldn't put it on par with falling as a risk for breaking your hip. But.
Okay, some other reasons for going to the ER, which I think would be interesting to see how public health factors in. Believe it or not, a lot of people go to the ER because they have severe toothache. Now, how's public health and toothaches? Does it have anything to do with what you do?
Yeah, well, I think we're big proponents of doing preventive kinds of things, right?
Okay.
So there are actually in some parts of the world, the country, health departments that will run dental clinics, so try and encourage people to get in there. We've actually sponsored some mobile dental clinics in the area where people come in and get cleanings and stuff like that. But it fits into the constellation of prevention, trying to keep cavities away instead of wait for them to try and get them fixed and then they're, painful. That kind of fits into that whole mode of what we try and accomplish, which is think about your health before it's gone kind of thing. But in this scenario, that does fit into the dental realm. But certainly going for your checkups every 6 months makes a big difference. And dental issues can carry into lots of medical issues,
We're on the same wavelength. I was going to say, I've heard that having severe dental problems could affect your heart, your the muscles in your upper body, and things like that.
You can even end up with bacterial growth on the valves of your heart.
Wow.
And stuff because of that. It's a constant feed of bacteria into your system that ends up going through and then building up on places that it shouldn't be. So if you have a heart valve, for example, they'll always give you antibiotics if you're going to do dental work on you because that, is a correlated risk, things like that.
So. Wow. That's scary.
I've never heard that. That's really frightening.
Okay. What if I am just maybe a little confused, a little dazed, confused, maybe dizzy? I know why. We were in the hot tub for a while, maybe too long, my wife and I. When we got out, we were both kind of dizzy and woozy. But is that a reason to go to the ER? And if it is, are there preventative measures? And I guess you would have to consider the source mostly, right?
So they're going to the ER because they're dizzy or because they got out of the hot tub and they're dizzy?
No, just because they're dizzy. I think I know why we were dizzy.
Yeah. Okay. So the hot tub is because you've got all the blood, you got all your blood vessels dilated and you've got your blood all spread out throughout your body, and so it's hard to keep your blood pressure up. But that's a little different game than just being dizzy. If it's a fast onset and you that can be a sign of stroke or your blood pressure is really out of line or something. So it can be a much more of a warning flag than some other things. If it comes on just all of a sudden you're feeling fine and then all of a sudden really dizzy and you can't figure out what's going on, and maybe there's some other things like numbness in a limb or something like that, I would go for that.
Okay.
But if it's you're slowly getting dizzier kinds of things, then I think that's a visit to your primary care doc, who's going to do a better job of investigating that than they would in the ER. But part of the problem with going to the ER is their mission is to patch you up and send you out. They don't right. do the investigation and try and really figure out what's going on.
They make you a little bit better and then say, go see your regular doctor.
So you end
doctor.
Up adding to the cost of your health care, but not really getting to where you need to be. And so
true.
So if it's not an event that's going to, you know, be a threat to life and limb kind of thing, it's better to just go to your regular doctor anyway. So,
all right, let me get a commercial. One more commercial break in. More with Dr. Blodgett and Mello after this.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
We have Dr. Blodgett on today on the Andy Griffin Show, usually on Wednesday, first Wednesday of the month, but this first Wednesday of this month was New Year's, so I like having Dr. Blodgett on, so we asked him to come back, and he graciously agreed to come in, and he even brought his beautiful wife today. That's nice. So, thank you for coming.
Definitely
appreciate
the better
it.
Side, right?
Yeah. Mello is here, too, today. She wanted to sit in on our discussion with the doctor. I did want to mention, coming up tomorrow, Jack Lancaster will be on the program. Looking for, I'm turning the music down. Looking forward to that. Let's see. Later on this week, we've got Sean Christensen, Chamber of Commerce, Dave Romer, Nanette Billings will join us. And just for the record, we will be here on Martin Luther King Day. In fact, Mello has agreed to join. Are you still joining me, Mello?
Yes. I'm going to California over the weekend, but I'll be back by Monday.
Oh, that's so kind of you to come mm-hmm. back just for me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I appreciate that. Next week, Washington County Commissioner, I believe it's Adam Snow's turn. Also, we'll hear from Zach Renstrom to talk about the fact that we are kind of in a drought, folks. Hello. We have enough water for this year, but and I'll get a confirmation on this next week when he comes on. But if we don't get a significant amount of moisture next year, we might be in trouble.
Yeah,
this year not so much.
It seems pretty yeah. obvious, right, from this year.
We will also hear from Chad and Dave are going to join me again from the city next week, next Thursday, to talk. Chad Lewis is the Economic Development Director. And it's not Chad Lewis. I just remembered it's Chad. It's like Chad Wilson, Chad Taylor, something like that. Anyway, I'll get his name right, and we will get you guys all on the program next week. Looking forward to that. We're with Dr. Blodgett today. He was former chief resident at Johns Hopkins University. That's pretty cool feather in his cap. He decided to come back here to Southern Utah, and we're glad you're here.
Appreciate I'm glad you being to be here. Here. Thank you. For
good place to raise a family,
you're,
though,
you're
too.
You're always
right?
kind to me, and yeah. I appreciate
It's funny. When I first moved to Southern Utah, I lived in Cedar City the first year I was down here, and then I moved to St. George after that. And a couple of things happened. First of all the when I was going to move from Cedar, and I told people I was moving to St. George, they were all like, "Oh, you're going to St. George." Cedar City folks don't like St. George. And when I first moved to St. George, the feeling was mostly mutual. St. George yeah. folks didn't really like, I don't know if it's an old rivalry.
It is the old rivalry, right? Yeah. Big gangs of people with blue and white and red and gold
yeah,
roaming
yeah.
around trying to beat each other up.
But I have found now that rivalry is not as fierce as it used to be. No. And that comes with now two high schools in Cedar City and, you know, Dixie State / now Utah Tech becoming bigger and, what, five high schools or something like that here in St. George, so it's yeah. definitely diluted the rivalry.
But yeah, it's mm-hmm. the good old days are gone, I guess.
My good friend of mine from Cedar, he says, "Yeah, we used to call you all a bunch of sorghum lappers down there in St. George." And I'm like, first of all, I don't know what sorghum is, and second of all, I'm positive I've never lapped any of it, but okay.
Sometimes things don't make sense, but they're fun anyway.
I had a good friend who was a baseball coach at Cedar High for a long time, Larry Cotterbaugh. I don't know if you know Larry, but he was the first person I'd ever met that had had valve replacement surgery in his heart.
Right.
And it had been a decade, and now Larry's still around. It's been 30 years since sure. he got his heart valves replaced, and he's still going strong.
That's, technology is
that's pretty amazing.
All the time. A lot of times those are pig valves, by the way. So
yeah?
Take them
is
out
that
of
what
a
it was?
Put them in,
pig valves. Huh? I haven't asked them what kind of animal was inside of them.
Apparently the genetics are similar enough that they don't get rejected very often.
He told me, though, and maybe you can confirm or deny this, they actually kind of had to kill him, so they had to disconnect his heart, right? And have a machine basically pump his blood for him?
Yeah, you put him on a heart bypass machine, which take heart lung bypass, so it takes over those basic functions for you, and they shut everything down, and it's crazy stuff.
How long is this supposed to last? Has he had to have gone in, because I haven't talked to him in years, has he had to have gone in and get him replaced again?
If it's a pig valve, or a replacement valve, a cadaver valve, they can last for the rest of your life. But if it's mechanical, generally they don't last that
long. Okay. I did get a text here. Sometimes when you get dizzy, we were talking about getting dizzy and trips to the ER. Says sometimes when you get dizzy and stand up, it has to do with dehydration. I deal with that. Took me a long time to figure it out. So that may be another reason for getting dizzy is not...
And it can be complicated. And if you're struggling with that, I'm not trying to be flippant. I definitely think it's something you want to talk to your doctor about. But as far as rushing to the ER and you know, waiting and all the stuff that happens at the ER, you're probably going to, unless it's really acute and coming on quickly, you know, you're going to do better just going to your regular doctor.
Now, I'm going to change the topic a little bit. You have teenagers now. I had teenagers. Mine are all, my youngest is 21 now, so I'm just out of the teenage thing. But it strikes me that your job in a lot of ways is like trying to tell a teenager not to stay out too late.
Yeah.
When you tell people to exercise and eat right and get enough sleep, most of us are going to be, whatever, you know, and we're going to do the wrong thing anyway. Is that a frustrating part of your job? Does that drive you nuts, or have you come to terms with it now?
Yeah, you get wise over time and you figure out, you know, you can, some people will actually do it and then you get excited about that. And
when you have to think about it, like my patient is a population of 250,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
which is weird for a doctor. A lot of the time, the doctor is a patient, not all the patients.
Right. The average primary care doc, for example, has a patient load of about 2,000, you know. So I get this variety of people, and so you always try and think of it in line of, well, what can I do to get 1% better results here? Mm-hmm. You know, nudge it along, and 1% on a 250,000 population, you know, is a big deal, right? That's how you have to do the intellectual exercise there.
Comfort yourself.
Could I just say a couple of things?
Absolutely.
Before we finish
up. He must have got a text from Heaton, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, we talked about this before we come. But of course, we work together on these things. But our health magazine is coming out right now.
It is. That's right.
And it's a special edition issue. So remember we did sleep about 2 years ago. Now this one is emergency preparedness. So the whole issue of the magazine is on principles around being prepared for the bad times, come what may. I think it's really got some great information. It's designed, it's got a little thicker cover to it, and so it's designed to keep it, you know, and
it'll last through the Holocaust or
use
whatever.
Use it to create your family plans and those kinds of things. So
that's pretty cool. Now you just have the letter in the front. Do you have a byline this month and a regular story or?
I was more involved in making sure it was where it needs to be. But I have the initial letter on why we think it's important, and then a lot of it's we talk to the emergency planners in the area and have them put stuff in, and our emergency preparedness staff, things like that.
Nice. We got a minute left. What else you got?
Okay. Every year, this time of year, they come out with there's a mystery illness in China. It's going to be COVID again. And it's always overhyped, and it's not. So this year, they've discovered it's HMPV, which is in the same family as RSV. It's been well known for a long time, and so don't fall for the clickbait of mystery illness in China. Mm. And there has been circulating in our country H5N1, which we've been tracking for a long time.
Is that the bird flu?
That's the bird flu, right?
Okay.
And so it's killing off a lot of birds, and about 70 people have been infected, and then there was one gentleman that died over 65 of medical conditions. Mm. We're tracking it closely, but so far, low risk in the population. It hasn't gone person to person like we worry about, but we're watching it. So
All right. This is Dr. David Blondia. Thank you, Doc, for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the chance to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for playing with us today.
Thanks, Dr. Blondia.
We'll be back tomorrow. Jack Lancaster. Talk to you then.